Hello and welcome. Today we are joined by this genuinely is a very special guest, which we'll go into in a second, Rick Fenoglio, who is retired sports science teacher and youth scout for Man City. Now that the big bit I left out there was I was at university and Rick was one of my tutors, so we're going back a long time now.
Wow.
And Rick randomly popped up on one of my posts on LinkedIn recently, so I made contact. So Rick, it's been well, what would it be? It's actually been probably 25 years I would have seen you. So, how are you doing?
I'm doing really good. Looking forward to having a chat with you. I was on your last podcast. I listened to Rob Madden, and he was a really interesting guy. And he was talking about the relationship between music and creativity and helping athletes and stuff like that. So to kick off, right, we're going to do a little song and you're going to help me. Okay. So
Yeah, well, we couldn't hear that. Was that a harmonica?
you couldn't hear that.
We couldn't hear it. Oh, yes. I
You
got
got
that
that.
bit, yeah.
Okay. Right, so I need your help. So you're going to keep rhythm, and I've written a half of a song basically about Give Us Back Our Game, the youth sports program that I helped start. Right, so are you ready? So I need you to do this. One, two, three, ba-dum. One, two, three, ba-dum. One,
One,
two, three.
two, three, budum. One, two, three,
With your
budum.
fingers if
One.
you can. Can you do it on the desk? We can't hear that.
They're too good at sound cancellation.
Okay, right. So you can go one, two, one, two,
One,
right.
two,
Bum,
three,
two,
budum.
three,
One,
bottom.
two, three, budum. One, two, three, budum. One, two, three, budum. One,
Well, I
two,
went
three, budum.
down to
One,
watch
two, three,
football.
bidum. One,
I
two,
went
three,
down
bidum.
and
One,
sat
two,
on a
three,
wall.
bidum.
I went
One, two,
down to
three,
watch
bidum. One,
football,
two,
and
three,
what do you
bidum.
think I
One, two,
saw?
three, bidum.
I saw
One,
parents
two, three,
shouting and
bidum.
drinking
One, two,
cola. He
three,
must have thought he
bidum.
was Pep
One,
Guardiola,
two,
but he was about as
one,
tall as
two, three,
Gianfranco
bidum.
Zola. Give us back our game. I saw parents saying, "Hey, ref, you really are stupid and need an eye test. And there's a 2-for-1 at Vision Express. Give us back our game. Oh, give us back our game. Oh, Lord, give us back our game. To all the adults in football, give us back our game." There
Very good. Very nice.
I don't
That's
know
it.
if you
Yeah, I
get.
don't remember the lectures like that. That would have been great.
Well, one of the things that, so I lectured for 30 years, right, at Al Sager. And I used to make, sometimes I'd write songs about the content that we had. So that's the only thing the students remember about me is that, I mean, I taught them so many different topics and stuff, but the thing they remember is when I wrote a song called The Quantitative Cowboy. And it was about the difference between qualitative and quantitative ways of doing research and viewing things and stuff like that. So I wrote it on my guitar, brought the guitar into the class, had some of the guys play harmonica, but they didn't know that I gave them the wrong key. So they didn't come off too well, but it was a big hit. And that's what students remember me by.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like those little things where you're there to learn, very academic stuff, but when really it's always about those connections, emotions, and just the relationships that you develop from things.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, higher education can be very, very dry and quite boring. We were talking about it earlier about science. Fantastic. Science is beautiful, but it can also be cold and dry. And you kind of end up thinking, where's the person in this? Where are the humans? So, again, we'll talk about this in a minute. But I went through a real, I guess, transformation when I started working at Manchester Met. It was then Crewe and Al Sager College in the sports science department. We had a very scientific department, and I got 3 or 4 years into it and just like you said, you know, I started talking, is this it? Is this what sport is really all about? And obviously the answer is no. It's about people and society and more qualitative aspects. So in that time, I got really heavily interested in phenomenology and different ways of doing research, qualitative mainly. And it was fairly new at the time. But basically, I became the hippie. I went all hippie on everybody. And I really, really enjoyed that aspect of it, finding out stories, finding out people's journeys, you know, interviewing parents, interviewing young players. So that's really still where my interests lie in terms of doing research within the game. But it's an age old, problem in a sense, that the differences between quantitative ways of viewing and qualitative ways of viewing. And there's really still two camps, you know, so it's changed a lot, but more needs to be done, I think.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like the number of people that I interview, and I've chatted to over 150 people now, and so many of them have said, like, they've all gone to university, or most of them have, yeah. And they've said, oh, I struggled academically, da, 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 and they've gone on to do great things in the world of sports medicine in this particular instance. And I even put me in that category of, I don't think I loved a lot of the academic way of doing things, but then I really enjoy the other. It's difficult to get that balance of the academia.
Yeah, I think the word or the term sports science is kind of confusing, because it makes it sound like sport is about science and science, is about sport. But, most of the people in the game and people in your profession, they played sports, they fell in love with sports, they liked the experience of it. And then to come in to an academic setting and find out it's all about, statistical analysis and ANOVAs and stuff like that, it can be quite, this is not my experience. And it's a difficult one for many people. I was never a very good statistician. I didn't really have any interest in it. I just literally wanted to explore the space of playing sport. What is that like for people? So I've tried to do that. But yeah, it's a real issue, really.
And so how did you get started in that career path?
Wow. Okay, so I'm a baby boomer. I'm one of the last of the baby boomers. Okay, so it's all my fault. Everything that's happening, it's our fault, okay? So I grew up in the Midwest in America. So I am American, but I've spent half my life there, half my life in the UK. So I'm a Yankee Brit. So I grew up in the Midwest in Northern Illinois in a place called Rockford. And then when I was 14, my parents moved to Tennessee. So into Bristol, which is in the northeast corner in the Appalachian Mountains. And what I remember about my childhood, there were seven of us. Yes, I have six brothers and sisters. And basically we ran the environment. This was, people harp back on this about, back then we climbed trees, we made forts, we owned the environment. Our parents would, we'd get out at, on a Saturday at 8 or 9 o'clock, and we'd be out all day, all weekend, doing everything, just owning the space. It was really good for our physical development because of the variety of activities we were engaging in. So that kind of led eventually into some of the things about Give Us Back Our Game, which I'll go into a second. So my sporting career was basketball was my first love. I wanted to be Pistol Pete Maravich when I was growing up, but also played soccer, also did athletics, pretty much a sporty. And when I moved from Illinois to Tennessee, the one thing I really picked up very quickly was this concept of subcultures, because the subculture in Northern Illinois is very different from the one in Tennessee. So, subcultures have their own language, they have their own values, they have their own way of doing things and stuff like that. So that was the first time, at age 14, I really had to adapt to a new situation. And sports helped me do that. No, there's no question about it. It gave me entry into my high school, gave me some success on the basketball court and American football. And because of that, I was one of them, you know, even though my accent was different, you know. So yeah, really interesting.
Yeah. And then, so at what point were you starting to get an idea of what career path you wanted to do?
Well, that really didn't happen until I was at university, at the University of Tennessee. I spent a year at Tulane University. I thought I wanted to be a doctor like my father. But halfway through, I just thought, you know, this was his wish, not mine, that type of thing. So I looked around for other academic disciplines and I couldn't really find any. Sports science really hadn't kicked off by then. I did a business degree, graduated in business management, then had to go back into university and eventually got a master's degree in sports fitness and science. Went to work in Boston at a health club. I was a fitness center director and all that stuff. Cut a long story short, my wife at the time was English, and so we got 5 years in Boston, and then we wanted to make a move. So it was either go back to the Midwest or go to England. We chose to go to England, and I'll be honest and say the opportunities for me came when I landed over here, basically.
Right. So how did you end up with an English wife then?
Because I played soccer, right, at University of Tennessee, and all the British and other country exchange students, they go to American universities for 6 months. So all the Brits hung out with the soccer team. So we all were, you know, big gang. And so, yeah, she and I got together, that type of thing.
Very good. Where's she from?
We're no longer married. We'll save that for another podcast. It's all good. She's from Wythenshawe, Manchester, basically.
Oh, right. Yeah. So very close to me then. I'm in Didsbury. So, yeah, very close. Okay. So for like the business degree then, like what was that like, and how helpful has that been for you just in from a general perspective?
I mean, looking back, I didn't put much effort into it. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I got it because I thought it would give me the best, because I didn't know what to do. I thought it was a fairly general thing to get a university degree. And I had, and I still don't really have much interest in business as such. It was just something I thought, you know, you don't know what you want to do, get the degree. I wasn't a great student. I was mostly interested in learning to play soccer, and just being a university student, to be absolutely honest about it. But things happen, you know. You have to make the most of what's in front of you, and you have to be a bit fearless, and you have to kind of think a lot about what are the options and where I want to go, you know, like everybody does. I'm not, you know, special in that sense, but it's all come together, and I'm more than grateful for everything I've been able to do in the past 30 odd years, whatever.
Well, no, definitely. And then, so what were the opportunities when you did get to England? What were they?
Yeah, I had a year and a half as a training facility director at Bisham Abbey National Sports Center. There, I was asked by the BOA, the British Olympic Association, to become a conditioning advisor. And they said the only sport we have left is downhill skiing or skiing. And so I said, okay, I will do this. All right. So I did that for a couple of years with the development squads. But my ultimate dream was to kind of get into football, because I simply fell in love with the game after so many years. And so I had to start planning. Okay. So I thought, if somebody looks at my CV now, what are they going to see? Not a whole lot in football. So I volunteered to do work at Port Vale, volunteered to work at Bury, did some coach education stuff for the FAW in Wales. A lot of this came from the group that you know on the PFA boys who did a degree. I was the course leader for that. So again, these contacts and opportunities just come up. And because I knew what I wanted to eventually get to, I wanted to work for Man United. then I thought about it in the sense that somebody looks at your CV, what are they going to see? So I tried to get more experience, simply as that. Subcultures, again, football, what a strong subculture. You know, it's got it, the lads, you know, the boys, the language, it's a really strong one. And I had to learn that as well. Being a fairly green American, learning the subcultures of British football is a bit, it was a pretty big step. I enjoyed it immensely. So a couple of things I learned, you know, if they're not making fun of you, then you're in trouble. You know, so the British type of humor, I love that. I mean, you know, Americans, I love the language. I love language. I love dialects. I love, you know, accents. You know, America has probably four accents, you know, the Southern accent, which is really long and drawn out because of the heat. And the Boston accent, where you park your car and stuff like that, because it's so cold, they chop everything off. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But in England, it's like 10 miles down the road from Alsatia was Stoke or Liverpool or, you know. So I loved all that. And so I tried to learn all that, become ingrained in it and use it in a sense.
So when you'd moved up to doing the work at Port Vale and Bury, had you moved up to the Northwest at that point then?
Yeah, that's right. After Bisham Abbey, I got the job at Alsatia College, MMU, simply because I phoned up Les Berwitz and said, I'm over from America. I have X degree in sports science and strength and conditioning was basically what I was into. And he said, and I think it was because at that time, it's no longer like this, that American sports science and conditioning was a bit ahead of where the British, you know, strength and conditioning community was at the time. This was the era when rugby players didn't look like they look today, and the strength and conditioning was at a fairly young stage. So I will say I did have a, you know, experience in that. And Les Berwitz said, come up and do an interview. I wanted the job, so I really prepared well, and I got it. And so we moved up north. It was great.
What was the job?
Yeah, it was physiology. I mean, it was physiology department. I was into wellness. I was a wellness coordinator, strength and conditioning. My pure physiology, exercise physiology at the time, wasn't, you know, as good as it is now. I'll tell you one thing. If you have to teach something, man, you learn it. Okay. So if you really want to get some knowledge, sign up to teach somebody something, you know, or lecture. You know, it's the stress that causes you to know your stuff and learn about it before you stand up there and, you know, be brave and fearless and act like you know what you're talking about. You know?
So what was that like then when you were going in and you were, I guess you were then teaching the students as they were coming through? How did you find that?
Daunting for the first couple of years, you know, being a lecturer is like being on stage. I had a rock band for a while and all that. And so it's a bit of a performance. But again, the same things apply. I was scared as hell. Okay. I was nervous. Everybody is when they lecture. You're probably nervous. If we put a heart rate monitor on you now, both of us would be a little, you know, elevated and stuff. It is never easy, right? I don't think. It wasn't for me, but once you get up there and do it enough and you start to relax, you start to get into the flow and letting things go and just trying to enjoy it, even though it is a very stressful environment. But again, from my music stuff, I took stuff from being on stage in a band to lecturing to students, trying to make it fun, trying to make it interesting. I loved it. It's stressful, but hey, you know, be fearless. I try to be fearless. It's certainly not easy.
Yeah, no, we always came back as very, very laid back. Is that because when you're on the receiving end?
See, this is an absolute myth, right? People tell me this all the time, man. You're so laid back. You just let things. It's false.
Well, it came across well. It came across like you knew what you were talking about as well. So that's got to be good.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Because you never think as no. Well, I certainly didn't then. You just think, all right, yeah, these guys are in their element. They love this. This is what they do. They don't like holidays. They don't like this. They just love science. And they just turn up, whereas we're like, oh God, I can't wait for reading week or whatever else it is. And yeah, it's probably, I guess it's the same for when you're doing a job, aren't you, basically?
Yeah. Again, I keep going back to this subculture thing, but you know, it is a job. It's a job. Simple as that. So the next thing that happened to me in my time at Alsager was I was trying to get into football. I wasn't having that much luck with the bigger clubs. Brian Kidd, Sir Alex's right-hand man at the time, I saw him in our office, in our secretary's office. And so it clicked that maybe Manchester United are looking or, you know, interested in this. So a couple of weeks went by. I got fed up at work. Probably, you know, you guys weren't doing your work. So I wrote down 50 sports science ideas for the Manchester United Academy. I sent it to Les Kershaw, the then Academy director, and kind of my life changed a bit. So he gave that list to a great friend of mine and one of my role models, actually, Tony Whelan at Manchester United. He got in touch. He said, we're doing a small-sided game pilot scheme. We need somebody to come and assess it. Would you be interested in coming over, having a chat, etc.? And I said, absolutely. You know, no problem with that. So that was I didn't research very much, but this was the one or two research things that I've done that have been reasonably successful. So I took a team of master's degree students. We went to Carrington. We Littleton Road, actually. We videoed 8v8s and 4v4s to parameters, passes, 1v1s, et cetera, et cetera. Fairly easy research, to be honest. It was simply videoing and counting and qualitatively deciding what happened in that particular play. And then it got published through the FA Insight magazine. It went around the world. Led again to some other things. This is the way it happens, you know. Something happens, you kind of see, could that lead somewhere else or what's happening? And then it just started coming in. My life just kind of took another path.
What year was that then? What year did that you give that dossier to them?
Yeah, that one was 2003 or 4, something like that. They then asked me to do a couple of other things. Do the submission for their EPPP, their Academy Performance Plan, do their Academy syllabus and stuff like that. So I did jobs for them for a decade, basically. Great, you know, I really loved it. And one of the things about Manchester United at the time, once you're in the door, you know, they don't let, you know, I knew I was privileged. I knew that, you know, I was just a kid from Midwest America. But once you're in the door, it was amazing. It was a family, basically. I know there's politics and there's coach, you know, personalities to deal with, but on the whole, they really welcomed me, treated me like one of their own, and so it was a really, really great experience.
You know. So how often were you at Carrington? So were you in the one opposite the first team training facility? You know, they've got the academies on the same campus, but opposite, isn't it, with the...
Yeah, this was, I mean, the 4v4 was actually before Carrington. Were still at the Cliff on Littleton Road. They were just building Carrington I think I got my dates right, but the subsequent ones, the performance plans and all that stuff, that took place at Carrington in the coach's office and stuff.
And so were you still doing work at MMU at that time?
Yeah, this was in addition to my normal lecturing stuff. But I was happy, man. I was, you know, this was my dream job, you know. So I had accomplished that goal and tried to do as best I can. And, you know, that it's brought me a lot of, I don't say a lot, but, you know, people in many countries know me by that study, you know, the 4v4 stuff. It was one of the first ones to kind of quantify the differences between larger sided games and smaller sided games. Simple as that.
So what was different then between what you were doing that got people excited?
Nothing. I numbers. People love numbers, man. People love statistics, and this research, you know, gave them some quantifiable data to say small sided games are potentially better for player development because they're touching the ball more. You know, 4v4 situations and small-sided situations occur in real gameplay, so it's highly relevant and specific. You know, I'm sure a lot of the notoriety came from just having the Manchester United badge on it. There's no question about that. Again, that led to some other things. So because of the 4v4, and the interesting thing about the United scheme was not just the 4v4 stuff. It was the way the coaches, how they acted, basically, on the touchline, right? So there's no shouting, right? The kids refereed themselves. The coaches were only there to give positive feedback. No scores were kept. Did the kids know what the score was? Of course they did, but it wasn't highlighted that Manchester United beat Liverpool 10-0, okay, or the other way around, as it happens. Sorry. but that was highlighted as well, the qualitative aspects of why they were doing this scheme. They wanted to build technical skills. They wanted the kids to play with no fear. They wanted the kids to try things, make mistakes, learn intrinsically from doing this, free them up so that they can learn the game and fall in love with the game for life. And that is so, so important, because the issues still exist, you know, all over the world in youth football. So as a result of that, I got a phone call from a coach in Cirencester named Paul Cooper. And basically he said, I hear you did the Manchester United work. We're really fed up with what's happening in youth football. Would you like to get involved? And I said, of course. So we started, he and I started the Give Us Back Our Game campaign, which 2007, 2008, 2009 made some waves, I would say, and helped pave the way for the kind of the smaller sided formats that we have today. So a article came out in the Daily Telegraph, and he and I, Paul and I, were asked to do over 100 media interviews and stories and stuff like that. So that taught me another whole bag of lessons about how the world works and how the media works, etc. We had a meeting with the FA, told them what they were very interested in, what we were doing and why are you doing it and what are your plans, etc. And you know, it took 8-10 years later, the FA went out and did their own road show and got feedback about the youth game, and 10 years later all the ideas that we had for youth football were put into place by the FA. They then got picked up in America, and the small-sided, you know, change happened. So I will not say that we were wholly responsible for that, but we played a good part in it. So
I think because England's got the reputation, or they historically have, of, you know, long ball, direct, that sort of thing, certainly not that long ago as well. So was this something that was going on, say, you know, Barcelona are renowned of being, you know, a tippy-tappy football?
Yeah.
Like, what was the state of play globally at that point?
Yeah, I mean, the Dutch have probably, we'll talk about Rinus Michels, and, you know, they were doing small-sided games a decade before anybody else, really. It was part of the Dutch system, basically. Free-flowing, but also in training, they do 3v3 to 5v5s. Tipitapa in Spain, same type of thing, because they play the ball on the ground. You know, it is small-sided. So England was certainly, we were late to the game, and other countries are even later to the game to utilize. And now we have constraints and all these other things. Keith David's one of the main proponents and creators of constraints, was at MMU at the time. So the world, the footballing world, the training world has kind of gone to it as well. So those two things happened at the same time, really. Constraints, approaches were coming in. People were playing more smaller-sided football, and they matched and fit really well together. So they you know, took off, basically.
I did my FA coaching certificate in 2000 at Alsager, so at the end of my course. Oh, yeah. And I found it fascinating, but it was hard. Like, the guy came from Crewe Alexandra. You probably know him. But it was really good. It was really very insightful and definitely useful for a number of different areas, not just from a football coaching perspective. But I think that was based around six on six. I think was a lot of the principles that they worked on. So when you were pulling this in there, what was the age group of the people that you were doing it with?
What, at Manchester United, they were under nine. They were under nines. So young kids, you know, childhood and kids. And, you know, Manchester United were absolutely groundbreakers in trying to make that environment more child friendly. And we talk about it a lot these days. But, you know, they were one of the first ones to actually change that environment to make it more child friendly. And you know, we can take a lot of lessons for it. A lot of groups are now starting up and have started up about, you know, even Give Us Back Our Game too, you know. So there is more attention on it, but same problems still exist. You know, absolutely same problems. Like I said in my song, you know, we have win-at-all-cost coaches. We have shouty parents and poor training environments too often. And it hasn't really gotten better in 15 years. I really don't think. I think it's gotten worse. You know, the coaches are doing better activities. They're doing smaller sided games, more touches and stuff, but the environments in which matches mainly, but also training at times, is, you know, sad. It's sad, and we can do better, basically.
So the parameters that you'd set around the coaches not saying anything on the side, not keeping score, was that something that how would you come up with that criteria of this is what should be in place?
I didn't. That was Manchester United. They wanted that environment. They wanted to play small-sided games in a good environment where they had no fear. They talk a lot about having no fear. So, yeah, that was a Manchester United implementation. Yeah, but it's, you know, so relevant today.
Yeah. Well, I saw in the paper recently someone getting stabbed on the sideline. It's just like, and then you go and it is a vile atmosphere. It's like, it's really, really bad. Not again, but it's for young kids.
Yeah, I know. And the more you look at this problem, the more you see the pivotal role that the coach plays. You know, the coaches are both the creator of the environment, the gatekeepers, the bit between the game and the kids, and they have so much power. And the kids don't really have any ownership. Most of the time, it's all coach-led. You know, it's coach-directed. But to keep kids involved and keep them coming back and playing and keep them retained, they need some more ownership. At least say, all right, guys, girls, what are we going to do today? What do you think we need to do? Why do you think we need to do it? Giving ownership builds retention. They have a piece of it. It's part of them. It's not, you know, unidirectional. It's like teaching. It's like lecturing, right? If I really wanted to do a nice, good lecture, I would stop it at 20 minutes because I know that you guys would be falling asleep by then. You do something different. You mix it up, you keep it fun, keep it light, and keep them engaged. It's the same principles.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of stuff. I've been to a lot of and seen a lot of people speak about this. And I've had Kelvin Giles on here where he's talking about, you know, just in general, letting kids play and not being just shoehorned into, say, one sport of football. If you start playing at 3, 4, as they seem to now, and not being able to do like the general gymnastics and all those, that really isn't good. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's neuromuscular, you know, it's to build neural networks in young children that they need to be able to adapt to. I mean, football is amazingly complex. Let's be honest about it. Nobody, not even Pep, okay? Not even Pep can get a handle on this game. All right. It's so complex because it's chaotic. Things happening, you know, in chaotic situations. You don't know what's going to happen. And then the kids and our bodies are complex. You know, we have billions and trillions of nerves and neuromuscular motor units. We've got thousands of muscles, muscle fiber, et cetera, et cetera. So we're a complex being trying to play a very, very chaotic and ever-changing game, you know. So what this, it always strikes me, you know, I ask, what is this game? You know, seriously, the more you think about it, the deeper it gets, the more complex it gets, and the more wonderful it gets. You know, this is one of the reasons we love it, is because nobody knows it. it's wonderful, you know, and I hope we never know it, you know. So this gets back to that statisticians versus analysts versus qualitative coaching and creativity and flow, and the difference between the qualitative content. You know, it's just amazing. Everyone's got their part to play, but it's up to kind of the coach is at the focal point, you know, to make the decisions about what kind of environment they're going to have. What are they going to do today? Sports development is about two things, right? What do the athletes do? What's the environment they do it in? Simple as that, really. Get the activities right, you're on the winner. Get the environment right, get those two things together, and you're flying. It's simple, but it's highly complex as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, that you were talking about, you were at Man United in a great period for them. So what was that like there? Like, what was your interaction with Sir Alex and like all the other teams? Or what was the atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very professional, like all Premier League clubs and you know, most big clubs, it's very professional. The coaches are amazing. You know, some of the best practice is definitely at the academies. It's a very male dominant subculture, obviously. It's, you know, I don't work on the women's game, and I know that's a little bit different, but at the time, you know, it's the coaches. They talk a lot about players, but you know, they cover it all. They really do. And my hat's off to them. It's an incredibly difficult job to be at the center point between the fans, the parents, the FA, the Premier League, and the kids. You know, it's a tough one. It really is tough. My hats go off to them. My only situation with Sir Alex was when I had to apologize to him. So at the time, Give Us Back Our Game came out, there was a lot of media interest in it. And I was interviewed at Al Sajer, funny enough, about, I think England had just been knocked out of one of the Euros or something like that. And there was a press panic about the national team and stuff. So they interviewed me about, I will say that the reporter was not forthcoming in how he was going to report the story. So he interviewed me about Give Us Back Our Game and trying to give the game back to the kids. But he ended up writing a story about soccer scientist says it's going to be all right, you know, for England football. And I was like, come on, this is crazy. So he mentioned Man United and all this stuff. So Les Kershaw and Tony Whelan said, man, you got to write a letter. Okay, so I did. I wrote a very honest apology to Sir Alex, saying, you know, I was duped, I was naive, and I was, you know. But on a day-to-day basis, I didn't really have much, you know, I didn't have any, to be honest. It was, I was not part of the coaching staff. I was an external researcher. So that was fine, you know.
Yeah. And like, what's your thoughts on like the game now? Like, from my perspective, I loved that period of that, the late 90s, early noughties. That was my favourite era of football, just because technically now it's amazing. Like, you watch Man City v Man United at the weekend and it's like they're outstanding, whereas I lived the Man U of that time. Like, that was more exciting to me.
I mean, it's a really, really interesting question, because we obviously, it's progressed, and players are a lot more technically skilled. The game has moved on. Tactics are, you know, highly complex and highly, but, you know, I think the question you're asking is, have we lost something? You know, so we've progressed. We've got stats out of our backside about every little bit. Is it making the game better? VAR is coming in, technology is coming in. You know, things can't be disinvented. Okay, so we're stuck with it. But is it better? And, you know, I'm kind of leaning toward, I'm with you with this one. I don't know. It's a hard one, because, you know, it's less perfect. Okay, it's, back then it was less perfect. There was more gaps. There was more spaces. There were more goals. There were more fights. There were more. There was more aggression. There was more action. That's been taken away, rightly so, on many of the aspects. But, you know, have we lost something? But I don't think we can turn, you know, we can't turn the clock back. The FA and the Premier League can make regulations to fix many things, but yeah, I just, you know, I don't want to do this in my retirement and my old age. I don't want to sound like that, you know, back in my day we did you know, it was so much better. And I agree, that was an amazing time, certainly at Old Trafford.
Yeah, well, I think also, I don't know whether I just look back at it because I was maybe more into it then. I mean, I still watch a lot of football now, but it's probably more, I'm an Everton fan, I was more passionate then probably. I'm a bit more philosophical now.
You have to be.
But then it's also like, I mean, watched the Leeds-Leicester game in the Championship the week, and it was just amazing. Like, there were, it was a VAR goal ruled out, which shouldn't have been. But even the Leicester fan, who's a friend of mine, he was like, I actually don't mind because I prefer it to be just more in the game, even though that was quite pivotal in there. So it's more exciting.
It is. I mean, it's amazingly exciting. And the media, you know, it's a global media event right now, a Premier League game. It didn't used to be global. Now, I mean, look at the stadiums, look at Tottenham's new stadium and the Wembley of the North plans and all these things. It's global mass media so much more now. And we have to, you know, they wanted the money, you know, the clubs want the money. So it's a, how can I say it? It's progress, but is it, you know, is it real progress, and where is it leading us? We don't think about these things too much because we just let it happen. We just accept it, you know, and I'm not naive enough to think that things will change dramatically, but yeah, I just think, yeah, we've lost something. We've lost, again, back to the human touch. And it's about, yeah, the people side of it gets very quickly lost in the global mass media business, I think. And at youth level, this is where it really suffers, because at, you know, the professional game is one thing. The adult game is another, is one thing. Youth football is significantly, it's a totally different thing. Okay, what percentage of young players get to make a living out of the game? 1%, something like that. How many players are in the system? Hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands. Youth football has got to be different, and it's got to be developmental first rather than win. We say win at all costs. I don't think any coach is like win at all costs. But, you know, that competition is another thing about language. I think people use competition without thinking about it. There's, in my view, there's positive competition and there's negative competition. Without competition, soccer is a game, or football as a game is not a sport. You know, it's a game where you have to try to win, score goals, and beat your opponent. That's the nature of the game. Without it, it just becomes play. Okay, but it's just there's good competition and there's poor competition, the environments, etc. So we need to take another look at youth football and just say, are these competitive environments? We have to have competition. We love competition. It's great, but it has to be of the positive kind rather than the hyper competitive or negatively competitive environments.
Yeah,
that's my soapbox.
Yeah, well, yeah, good luck with that, because you sort of, you go down and you watch like some of these. I watch my nephews play football, and some of it is just like, oof, yeah, I'm not.
I know.
I just don't think it's that parents and just even the kids. It's just like the environment. It's that maybe that's just people though.
Yeah, maybe it is, but well, my opinion on that is change can happen, but you have to not only tell people what's wrong, because people just kind of turn off after a while. If you go onto LinkedIn or whatever, and I do this probably too regularly, I highlight the negative aspects of youth football. But real change only happens through the FA, through the Premier League. And when you really start to look at human rights of children, you know, we're getting to a point where a lot of these clubs and leagues, nobody ever talks about youth football leagues. They always talk about coaches and clubs. Leagues are really, really responsible for what happens. But they're skirting very, very close, many of them, to being in violation of the United Nations Charter or Convention on the Rights of the Child. That is gaining some traction, but we need to look at it again. It's like I said, it's gotten worse.
It's definitely it's not always pleasant to be around. I even like for the people I've chatted with, and a lot of friends that I've met over the last 18 years or so in this, and the chats that I've had on here, it's even from that, the medical department wise, like you can say it's progressed, developed, where they've got numerous, got a team of 20 or 30 even on the medical side. Whereas you speak to some people where it was literally one person, like Gary Lewin, there's like four people in the coaching staff when they won the league at Anfield.
Yeah. When I started Barry, there was the physio and he did everything.
Yeah, they do everything. But they loved that aspect of it, and they were involved in everything. And they say it's definitely improved now, as in the quality of care and everything. However, it's still lost something from there, and it's way more of a business than it being a maybe more of that sort of connection, I guess, with the club and the culture. And that's, I guess, that comes with money though, doesn't it?
I don't want to really get into a discussion about politics and capitalism and things like that, but in circumstances it does have a negative effect on people, young people especially, experiences. But that's a bigger topic.
No, it is. Well, just getting back to one of my really good memories was that, so when I got to Alsager, it was 97, and the year before Italy had been hosted at Alsager, and so they'd obviously gone to town on the pitches, and we were just immaculate. They were amazing. So we'd be playing football, probably we should have been doing more studying, but we were playing football like 4 or 5 hours a day. But it was just a great period. Like, what was it like being there in Euro 96?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. I walked down from my office to the gym and I saw Eusebio. You know, it was with the port. Yeah, I was like, I mean, a lot of Americans won't appreciate this, but I was like, oh my God, that is just an amazing moment, you know? And the Italian team, and just seeing how they worked. And at the time, This is quite interesting, because in America at the time, you had American football, basketball, stuff like that. And it was fully professional. It was more advanced. Football was still a little bit, it's football, you know, the boys and the lads and the players and stuff like that. So I was expecting, just hundreds of people, of you know, nutritionists and sports scientists and stuff like that. It wasn't like that at all. The Italian side had their masseuse and their physio, and that was about it, you know, and the players just got on with it. Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic. I loved it.
Well, they bombed a bit in that tournament, so maybe they should have had a few more people.
Yeah, actually, yeah, Portugal got further than Italy.
Yeah. But,
I mean, it gives you that glimpse of elite level sport, you know, and the differences between different levels and stuff like that. So, yeah, amazing stuff.
Yeah. So are you still in touch with any of the old team there, as in MMU?
Well, we're still in touch. I'm still in touch with a lot of your students and guys like you and Matt Radcliffe and Damian Roden and kind of the footballs, the PFA course. I'm still in touch with, you know, many of those and stuff like that. It was a great gang, you know.
So when was that PFA? Because I remember we were always a bit starstruck when we'd be in there and then you'd see like a Premier League player coming in and they were doing whatever they were doing. There was quite a few people of, you know, decent levels that were coming in training. Oh,
absolutely. Players from the Northwest. So the PFA funded a sports science course for players. They were normally players not in the Premier League and making, you know, loads of money. They needed to get a degree and have a job after the game and stuff like that. So we had Mondays and Thursdays were PFA sports science days. So they'd come in when they could from training, do their class courses and stuff like that. And a lot of them were really, really good students. You know, it was great fun. A lot of, you know, typical football lads, you know, lots of stories, lots of making fun of each, you know, it was great, you know.
Yeah, who else was part of that crew then? Like Damien and Matt have done great. Like their setup's brilliant.
Yeah, Mike Rigg from Welsh FA, Gareth Griffiths from Port Vale, Steve Weaver, who's now at Norwich, I think, and a few others. And they'll shoot me for not remembering their name at this time. But there you go, good bunch, about 12 of them. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is really good. And then just getting back onto something we were chatting about a bit earlier on, where you were saying that you've changed your view from like the quantitative to qualitative. Like, where do you sit on that now? Because sports science is very, you know, it's an academic. Well, a lot of aspects are, you know, maybe take the psychological side of things out, which I remember Brendan McGuire doing a lot of stuff on that. But it's like, where do you sit on that now?
Yeah, I think I mentioned earlier that at the time I will call it kind of an epiphany and a, you know, a transformation of my thought processes and stuff like that. And I wrote a paper about transformational learning in coaches. So coaches that start out as a kind of a win at all costs and then finally get more player centered. I did a study on that. It's really, really interesting. Where do I sit on that? The statistical, mathematical, scientific side is doing fine, right? They don't need me. The people first, humanistic, whatever you want to call it, approach and reminding everybody this crazy industry that kids are people and people are people, and, you know, let's think about that a bit more. You know, we've become so scientistic that, like I said, I think we're losing a lot, and we need to kind of think about people as people. It sounds such a cliche, and I'm sorry for that. It sounds like tree hugging lefty, you know, all that hippie stuff, you know, but it's not. It's about, you know, people having an enjoyable time and not being abused, basically, because or used too much, you know, in the game.
Well, I just think in general life, and I don't think it does sound hippie, because I think that's what it gets down to. Like, albeit I wouldn't be in this industry without my sports science degree. Really, a lot of the stuff that I'm interested in now is we're working with medical technologies and so on. So it's great to have sports science background. But really, what I'm interested in is people, helping businesses, helping development of whatever it is, and really adding value in that way. The equipment is important, But that is a, it's a small percentage, really. So it's like, how do we then support them, whether it's with education or implementation or engaging whoever they're engaging?
Yeah, we have to use tools, right? We can't let tools rule us. You know, we have to use them. And what's the ultimate aim is to make people's lives better and happier and more fun and all those other things. So yeah, I think we have a tendency to just, technology, great, you know, AI, great, you know, going to the moon, great, going to Mars, even greater. Okay, we always have to do better. We don't. Well, we need to redefine what better is, really. And I think that's happening a bit, but it, you know, again, not to be on a soapbox, you know, people's lives matter.
Yeah, that doesn't sound cliche.
That doesn't sound cliche at all. Anyway. Yeah, you know where I'm coming from.
I agree, because it's still you're kind of learning and
I'll end with that. That's a good thing about a harmonica. You can just whip it out at any time and break
it. It always works. So, you know, but I agree. I think you're always learning and developing stuff about yourself. And even though sometimes it seems obvious, you actually think, God, I feel like in the last year I've developed a lot in my head. Doesn't mean I don't have crap days and things, but you're always constantly looking for what the next thing is. So what would your advice be for people looking into sports science or this area of working in this area? What would your advice be?
Yeah, I think it is a subculture. Okay, so there's a group of sports scientists, physios and stuff like that, and they all have their thing and their own goal, and they make connections and stuff like that. So be aware, it is also a pretty strong subculture. The other thing is, you know, all of us have to do things that we have to do to in order to get paid, in order to live. Okay, I was lucky when I first was employed at MMU, Kurin Alsace College, I had a permanent contract. Okay, in America this would be unheard of, you know, tenure. Okay, so unless I really, really messed up, you know, I was safe and secure in my job. That allowed me to go and do projects and investigate football and all this other stuff. So that's, again, I have no magic wand for that, but it is helpful. You know, I sound like a granddad, you know, once the bills are paid, then you can go and get some enjoyment and stuff. That sounded terrible. I don't mean like that.
Yeah, no. Well, no, it's true though, isn't it? It is.
But if you want to get into sports science, there are some great people out there. There are some great institutions out there. BASES, the British Association, is very active and will help you along the way. And I guess my only message is do the science, be great at that, but just don't forget about the person or the people that you're working with. Boy, I sound like a...
That was good. That was good. No, I'm going to use that one. No, that's good. Yeah, but I think it's, even though it does sound cliche, right? I think a lot of people don't always remember that. It's like, yeah, that bit's important to have that box ticked, but it's everything else. That's what people remember. Like, I remember Les Berwitz coming to talk about BASES. Yeah. I remember him talking about it. I don't remember what he was saying, but I remember that the engagement of it, you know, you remember those different moments of things, and that's ultimately down to the way it's delivered, not particularly the content.
Yeah. I mean, I think people put a lot of faith in numbers and a lot of trust in numbers and a lot of, you know, meaning in numbers, and that's fine. Numbers, can, you know, statistics, whatever, scientific, amazing, you know, wonderful stuff. But, you know, don't lose sight of the people side, the qualitative side. Huge areas, obviously. Qualitative research has come on, and there are lots of creative ways to find out the stories of people. Podcast is one of them. Autoethnography is another. This is, you know, we would classify this as autoethnographic research. I'm talking about my life and trying to draw conclusions from it to different theories, etc. Storytelling, personal, you know, it's all really good stuff, and it's come a long way as well in the last 20 years. the methods of data reduction and drawing conclusions from qualitative data is much more firm and much more consistent than it's ever been. And it's great stuff. You know, there's some really, really interesting stories, you know, and the scientists will discount stories as it's biased, but yeah, okay, it's biased. All right, take from it what you can, and you know, it is still truth. As long as you take the steps to validate the stories as best you can, you know, it's a given. It comes with the territory. All right, it's qualitative. All right, you know. So,
and do you do much reading then? So, I'm a massive fan of personal professional development, so books, reading those sort of things. Is that something that interests you?
Yeah, it is something I like. Everybody, I probably read online too much. I really like philosophy, and I like looking at different philosophical approaches and trying to figure out how that relates to my world and all those other things. It helps me relax, basically, reading philosophy. I'm not a fantastic reader. I probably should be, but there's so much available so quickly. I probably read more than I think I do, just from scanning, you know, websites and online stuff.
what philosophical, are there any particular publications or books that you think are worthwhile checking out?
Oh, gosh. One of the biggest books that actually got me thinking about quantitative qualitative was Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by, I think it's Robert Pirsig, P-I-R-S-I-G. It was kind of a 60s American hippie classic where it looked at, just this, physical versus quality or emotion, quantitative versus qualitative. So that really got me going. And yeah, he's probably my favorite author. He's probably one of the, he's got two books. That one probably changed my life more than any others, I would say.
That'd be interesting. Yeah, I'll check it out. That's good. Yeah, my book list is getting bigger and bigger, so I need to get around to just drilling down on some of these ones. Great. And then, so just finally, what are you doing at the moment then? What's your what are you doing with your time?
Scouting for City. That's really good. I enjoy that. There's some really good guys. We talk a lot about players and technical aspects, youth players, and I scout for the MLS club New York City, and some under 21 live games and stuff like that. So seeing the different levels of skill and playing football and stuff like that has been really beneficial to me, to understanding the game. I'm also doing some American sports tours for university soccer teams that are coming over. We've got one next week from a group from Iowa. So it's kind of training, sightseeing and touring. And that's a whole lot of fun.
Sounds good. So just succinctly then, what are you looking for when you're looking at a player for scouting them for whatever? What are the characteristics?
Okay. So at City, like most clubs, they'll have a positional template. So what aspects are we, and it's nothing groundbreaking or earth shattering. It's, you know, five or six areas that you need to comment on. But for me, because of my sports science background, I look a lot at the movement efficiency of the player and, you know, movement efficiency and power, right? You get whatever you're doing in sport, if you have efficiency of movement and power to be able to do that efficiently, then you're onto a winner. Okay. That's the first thing. Next is what I look for in terms of playing technical ability. And it all starts with ball control, ball manipulation, and it moves out from the circle of the player from that. If they can control the ball when it's at their feet, they can do well in 1v1s, they can manipulate, they can change play, they can get space to make a longer pass and stuff like that. So I use that one a lot. And that was taught to me by a Welsh national player whose name escapes me, John Hartson. Look at the player in that circle of where he's at. Can he control the ball in there? move the circle out. Can he control the ball a couple meters in the circle around it and move it out, move it out, move it out? So I use that one a lot. But yeah, basically it's ball manipulation, 1v1s first, longer passing, and then there's the psychological, mental capacity, resilience. What are they like as a person or a player? It's really hard to get insight on that from video, which most of my stuff is. But how do they respond to the referee? How do they respond to fouls? All of it matters. All of it. From the minute they step on the field, if they're, you know, 14, I mean, I don't scout and I won't scout less than age 14, but, you know, 16, 17 year olds, they watch everything, you know, how they conduct themselves, et cetera.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. It's obviously it's big business now as well, isn't it, for getting those people at the right age. Yeah, brilliant. Look, Rick, really appreciate it. I've enjoyed catching up and reminiscing about the good old days.
You're a great student, man. You're just top of the class every time. I remember that so well.
Exactly. No. Cheers, Rick. I appreciate it.
And, okay, thanks to everybody. Yeah. Thanks for listening to me rabbit on.
Thanks, Rick.
Take care. All right.